From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the push to make sure minority business owners aren't locked out of the new marijuana marketplace in Massachusetts.
We have an opportunity to be deliberative, proactive, and intentional in ensuring that we don't see those disparities.
Also today, a new study says changing the way doctors are paid can mean better healthcare for everyone, especially the poorest patients. And the Dorchester educator named finalist for National Teacher of the Year.
I'm just thrilled. I'm so excited. It's just wonderful to have folks looking out and recognizing great teaching and learning.
Plus,
being in a violent country, you cannot act as though violence is not happening. Art does not give answers, only poses questions.
Civil War, Violence, and National Mourning in the Art of Doris Salcedo. It's Radio Boston. First the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Recreational marijuana has been legal for less than a month in Massachusetts, but groups are already making plans to ensure minority entrepreneurs are included in the state's newly legalized business. Last month, Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley held a hearing on the subject, and tonight, the National Cannabis Industry Association is meeting in Cambridge where they'll discuss ideas. So what can Boston learn from other cities that have already legalized marijuana? How have or have not minorities been included in legalized pot businesses elsewhere? Joining us with more is Shalene Title. She's a founding board member of the Minority Cannabis Business Association and a partner at THC Staffing, a recruiting firm for the legal marijuana industry. She'll also be speaking tonight at the Northeast Cannabis Caucus. Shalene Title, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, give us a sense as to what the numbers are regarding minority-owned businesses in states where marijuana has been legalized. You know, what percentage of businesses are owned by minorities?
Well, incredibly, we don't have official statistics on that, which is something that needs to change, first of all. But based on the data that we do have, it's a pretty dismal picture. The estimate is that 1% of retail marijuana dispensaries are owned by people of color across the country.
1%.
That's right.
Just 1%. Okay, so I see there was a March 2016 investigation by BuzzFeed that also found that number. And we were also looking at some numbers specifically, for example, in Colorado, right, where they say they have, 400 or so businesses, and just three of them are owned by minorities?
That's right. So Wanda James, who is the only black female owner of a dispensary in Colorado, had actually come to Boston for the hearing that Councillor Pressley held on this subject. And she testified that, yes, out of 400 dispensaries in Colorado, only three have black owners.
So what are we seeing as the major obstacles for getting more minority-owned businesses in the cannabis industry?
Well, there's a couple of things. And the good news is that we were able to learn from these past mistakes when it comes to Massachusetts law. So I think a primary issue is that earlier states actually prevented people with past marijuana convictions from getting a job in or starting a marijuana business, which is obviously a problem because we're trying to address the racial disparities in the war on marijuana, not perpetuate them. And so in Massachusetts, there is no such exclusion for people that have marijuana convictions. The other thing is barriers to entry in terms of sky-high application fees, really complex application processes, and a lack of capital. Mm-hmm. When you can't have traditional banking loans, then you have to have family or friends who are willing to lend you capital.
Right. And minority entrepreneurs have historically had a tougher time getting access to capital as it was, regardless of what the business is. And here in Massachusetts, as the law is currently written, the initial application for a license will cost $3,000, which is non-refundable, right?
That's right.
And the license and a full license for retail marijuana sales will cost some $15,000.
That's right. And compare that to our medical program where there's a $30,000 non-refundable application fee. So it's been reduced to 10%.
Okay, so then if we have these problems of already more difficult or a greater challenge in accessing capital, and then on top of that we have sort of uncertainties around which banks will or won't be willing to be involved in the nascent cannabis industry in Massachusetts, you know, what can we do to tackle that problem for minority entrepreneurs?
Well, there was a lot brought up at this hearing that Councillor Presley held, and I think a big part of it is just acknowledging that there's a problem to begin with and being proactive and intentional. So one thing that we're lucky to have in Massachusetts is a provision in our law that requires the regulating agency, the Cannabis Control Commission, to enact some type of procedures and policies that address this problem by addressing participation in the industry for people who are from these communities that have been historically targeted by the drug war.
Hmm. Well, in Oakland, California, for example, they have reserving half of all new permits to sell medical marijuana for either those who were arrested for cannabis-related crimes or those who have lived for 2 years or longer in certain Oakland communities that have had a high number of cannabis-related arrests. Now, as you pointed out earlier, in Massachusetts, we don't have the sort of we're not penalizing people who have had cannabis-related convictions if they want to enter the marijuana business, right?
Right.
But what about the second half of that idea about reserving some licenses for communities that have had a disproportionate number of arrests?
I think the intent there is so important and definitely something to learn from. What we've seen in Oakland is that perhaps those particular parameters might be too restrictive because they're having trouble finding applicants who meet exactly those requirements. So what I might recommend for jurisdictions here is that they first do some research to see what kind of applicants are out there, what their backgrounds are before they decide on the actual parameters. But yes, in general, I think that we need to be using this new industry to address the harms that have been done by the war on drugs for the past 40 years and have some kind of restorative impact.
Mm. Well, we're seeing some other examples of states that are trying different things because, of course, this is an issue that many states that have legalized marijuana are facing in terms of minority entrepreneurs being boxed out of the new market. In Oregon, I believe some cities there passed an additional 3% tax to assist neighborhood minority-owned businesses in an incubator program. Is there any interest in doing something like that here?
Yeah, that was brought up a lot at the hearing. My colleague, Jesse Horton, who's the chairman of the Minority Cannabis Business Association, was the person who worked on that in Portland. And it's the first time, actually, that a specific amount of tax revenue has been set aside to support the communities that have been targeted by cannabis prohibition. There's an interesting thing here where we weren't able to do that in the ballot initiative process. But now that legislators are talking about possibly changing the cannabis law, I think that's one improvement that could be made. We could look at how the tax revenue or the law enforcement cost savings could be used for those kinds of programs.
Right. You know, I think there's a lot of popular sentiment that that's critical of legislators at the moment because they're moving back the timeline rather significantly. Do you have any concerns that Beacon Hill lawmakers might maybe not necessarily be entirely friendly to proposals that would make it easier for businesses to get up and running in Massachusetts in the new marijuana industry, even if it's to help minority entrepreneurs?
Well, it's early to tell. So all we've seen so far is a 6-month delay. So what I'm hoping to see in these 6 months is a lot of data collected that will show what kind of changes need to be made, if any, and what that is based on, because we haven't seen that yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder about for small-scale businesses in general in these states where marijuana has been legalized, what kind of competition are they facing or have they faced for licenses from larger investors? Because this is a potentially giant industry that a lot of people with a lot of money are interested in getting into. I mean, have some small-scale entrepreneurs, you know, minority, female, or otherwise, been elbowed out because they just can't compete with the expertise and investment money from larger groups?
We've seen some of that. What I often tell people is that if you're looking at the long game and you're, say, a minority who wants to be get involved in the industry, one, if you start with a job at an existing dispensary, there's very few of those now compared to, say, in 10 years, when this will be likely a $1 billion industry in Massachusetts. And at that time, you'll have 10 years of experience when not a lot of people do. So look at the growth opportunities, one. And then number two, when you start a business that doesn't touch the plant, you don't need one of those special licenses. So my company, THC Staffing Group, it's a recruiting company. So we just need a placement agency license in Massachusetts. And there are a lot of women and people of color locally who own these kinds of ancillary business where you make things like software or accessories and devices, and you don't have to worry about those massive barriers to entry and competition.
Interesting. So sort of, as you said, ancillary, corollary opportunities that reduce the barriers to entry.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Shalene Title is a founding board member of the Minority Cannabis Business Association and a partner at THC Staffing, a recruiting firm for the legal marijuana industry. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, here's the holy grail when it comes to healthcare costs. We need to get costs down while also making people healthier, especially the most vulnerable patients. A new study from Harvard Medical School finds that something called an alternative quality contract might be accomplishing exactly that. Now, healthcare policy can be a thicket of incomprehensible jargon, so let's start with a little explainer from Michael Chernu. He's professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. And first, he explains how healthcare gets paid for most of the time, the traditional fee-for-service model.
The doctor got paid for everything they did for you, even if it was completely useless. And so there was very little incentive for the doctors in the hospitals to try to figure out how to most efficiently provide care to improve your health.
So all those blood tests, MRIs, other exams, healthcare providers get paid for all of them, even if you stay sick. For some time now, though, there are some physicians in Massachusetts and Massachusetts insurers who've been experimenting with a different payment model called the alternative quality contract. Chernu says it's a paradigm shift that forces doctors and hospitals to ask themselves an entirely different set of questions, such as,
how can I provide the best care for the patient for the lowest cost, looking at the entire patient as opposed to the specific service? And it therefore allows organizations that find ways to create savings, avoiding unnecessary imaging procedures, avoiding unnecessary surgeries. And likewise, it rewards them if they do a set of things that we believe will improve your health.
So that's a little healthcare payments 101 there. Now, to this exciting new Harvard study. Chernu and his team say they've got the data to show that alternative quality contracts work.
It lowers spending, improves quality, and in fact, improves quality a little bit more for the people that were most disadvantaged.
And it's that last part that has Chernu most excited. There's long been a concern that changing the way doctors are paid might inadvertently backfire on the poorest patients. Chernu's study, though, followed 299,000 Massachusetts Blue Cross Blue Shield members who live in poorer neighborhoods and about 245,000 members from more affluent neighborhoods. And they found that everyone got greater access to preventative care, but the gains were actually bigger for poorer patients. More checkups, more screenings, more blood tests.
In the alternative quality contract, there were strong rewards for the medical groups to make sure that everybody got better quality. The lower SES groups were starting from a somewhat lower level of testing, and so the medical groups invested more resources, or our results are consistent with the hypothesis that the groups invested more resources in improving quality for those folks, effectively bringing them up closer to where the higher socioeconomic status groups were.
Mm. And can you tell me a little bit more about what these rewards were for physicians or healthcare providers that may have led to this outcome?
Well, they had a relatively complicated process for reimbursing the medical groups based on their quality of care. If you did sort of maximally well at getting people tested and getting the outcomes better, those types of things. But essentially, they translated your clinical behavior into financial rewards of about 10% of total spending.
So really the overall finding points you to this idea that with this alternative care and payment model, folks who are lower on the socioeconomic scale were able to get as much or comparable rates of testing that's important in monitoring certain diseases such as diabetes.
Right.
But my follow-up question to that then is, that's great. They were getting more care and perhaps, but was it more effective care? Did it lead to better health outcomes?
In our study, we didn't find a big effect on health outcomes, but there's a number of reasons why that may be difficult to pick up with the data that we had. There were, for example, lags between getting tested and treated and moving through the system. So I don't think we're ready to say that we have made big changes in, for example, blood sugar levels or cholesterol levels across the different SES groups. Although I should note, both groups were doing better.
Both groups were doing better.
Both groups were doing better in comparable rates. So we didn't necessarily reduce the disparities, but the contract did seem to do somewhat better for both. The big message from our study is that we happen to be in an era where there's a lot of attention to transforming the way in which healthcare is paid in this country to hold the delivery system more accountable for spending and outcomes, because we believe that there's opportunities to both provide better care at lower cost if we can change the way that the incentives work within the healthcare system. And you see a big push to move to those new payment models in the entire state of Massachusetts. The big concern that people have had is that as these incentives change and give the delivery system the incentive to provide care more efficiently, that somehow the providers will skimp on quality. Within that concern, there's a big worry that that will impact the most disadvantaged beneficiaries, socioeconomically disadvantaged beneficiaries in the population. And so we undertook our study because we were interested in understanding if this move to new payment models would have a beneficial or deleterious effect on everybody overall, and in particularly the low SES population, which is often more vulnerable. And not only do we find overall improvement for both the high SES and the low SES population, we found some evidence. The more optimistic reading of the results would be that the alternative quality contract hit the trifecta. It lowered spending, it improved qualities, and it narrowed disparities.
But did it lower cost, and if so, by how much?
So we've published other work that showed that it did lower cost, and after 4 years, by about 10%.
Now, of course, we're having this conversation in the midst of many, many questions being asked about the future of the Affordable Care Act nationwide. Say the ACA does get repealed sometime soon. Would that change the trajectory in terms of how healthcare is going to get paid for across the country? Because, I mean, Massachusetts is one thing, but are there similar experiments being done elsewhere in the nation that could be set back if the ACA is repealed?
The one thing that is true is that there is another law on the books that is getting much less attention than the Affordable Care Act that reformed the way that physicians get paid by Medicare, which is called MACRA, favors payment models such as the alternative quality contract. And so there remains some reason to believe that there is momentum for these types of payment changes, even apart from what's going on in the Affordable Care Act. I think it is unlikely that we will return to a healthcare payment model that we saw back in, say, the 1990s or pick your time, because the concern about spending is so strong that the actual fees will increase at a very, very slow rate. All of these payment models, including the alternative quality contract, they allow healthcare providers, physicians and hospitals, to share in some of the savings if they practice more efficiently. We must continue to monitor and worry about the concerns about what will happen going forward, but so far, it seems that it's been a success.
Michael Chernu is a professor of healthcare policy at the Harvard Medical School. We've got a link to his latest study on health and process outcomes given differing payment models. We have a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. Professor Chernu, thank you so very much.
Magna, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
Back in a moment. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I have to tell you, I'm in the mood for some good news. Are you? Well, I've actually got some great news. A high school teacher in Dorchester has been named a finalist for National Teacher of the Year. Sydney Chafee teaches ninth grade English and social studies at Codman Academy Charter Public School in Dorchester, and she was also named Massachusetts Teacher of the Year in May, and she joins us now in the studio. Sydney Chafee, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's exciting to be here.
Congratulations. How does it feel to be a finalist for National Teacher of the Year?
It's amazing. It's a great honor. It's humbling. You know, there are so many teachers all over the state and all over the country doing amazing work, and it's a really great opportunity to be able to represent them.
Okay. So you teach ninth grade English at Codman.
I teach ninth grade humanities.
Ninth grade humanities. Yeah. Okay, so tell me a little bit about what you teach.
Yeah, so I teach a year-long course called Justice and Injustice, and we teach literacy through the lens of looking at these four historical moments where justice and injustice were at play. So we relearn the story of Columbus, we learn the story of the Haitian Revolution, right now we're learning about apartheid, and we end the year by talking about whether Puerto Rico is a colony or not.
Oh, I can only imagine. And do your students debate that?
Yeah, they do.
What are those debates like?
Oh, they're amazing. We spend the whole year talking about colonialism and talking about these moments where Europeans colonized various places and what happened and the justice and injustice that comes into play there, mostly injustice. And how did people fight for justice? And then we talk about America today and we say, okay, there's this place, Puerto Rico. Let's look at it. It's called a territory, but what do you all think? And they, you know, they really get into it and they talk about, they try to parse out, well, what's the difference between a colony and a territory? And they come up against the fact that the language is that there's a lot of gray area. Mm-hmm. And that's always really fun for me when there's no right answer, because that's when the kids get really fired up and they're really, really learning when I don't have the right answer and it's up to them to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And we end that usually by thinking about, so what should Puerto Rico be? Should it be a state? Should it be a territory? Should it be its own country? And that's really fun to see what they come up with.
Oh, fascinating. And I imagine that, in all the countries and areas that you talk about where you're looking at the lens of history through injustice and injustice, that maybe some of your students actually have family connections to those places.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons that my school, Codman Academy, wanted the ninth graders to learn about the Haitian Revolution is because we do have a large population of students who are Haitian American. So that's always fun to learn about that moment in history and have kids make connections with their own families and their own family history, and to really feel this sense of pride or be able to express that sense of pride about the place where they come from.
Mm. Now, you've been teaching at Codman Academy for
10 years.
Yeah. Time flies, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Had you taught anywhere else before that?
So I taught at Citizen Schools, which is an academic out-of-school time program. I did a fellowship there for 2 years. And before that, I was in college. I did one summer at Summerbridge, but Codman is the first school that I've been at.
Was teaching something that was a calling to you from a young age? Or
no, not that I knew of. You know, looking back now, I can sort of see it. You know, I was bossy and I like to learn things. And so I wanted...
Well, let's rephrase that and call it you were a natural leader.
There it is. No, I wanted to be a writer. So I went to Sarah Lawrence College to be a poet. And one of my mentors there was Lita Sizer, who is the daughter of Ted Sizer, great education reformer. And so she sort of started to introduce me to this world of progressive education. And I started doing some reading, and that's how I got into it. So I never studied education in college, not until I went to grad school. And then, you know, I realized very quickly, oh, this is what I love. This is my passion. I'm good at it. And it fuels me. And how wonderful to have a job where I feel really good every day, and I feel really excited about what I'm doing, and I'm constantly learning.
And challenged, I presume.
Oh, absolutely. There's always something to be better at. There's always something new to learn. So it's a really exciting job, absolutely.
Yeah. So let me ask you, in a speech or remarks that you gave when you were named Massachusetts Teacher of the Year, you talked about another source of inspiration, and that was your mom.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about her?
Yeah. So when I started kindergarten, my mother went back to college. She had left school to be a mom, and she'd stayed home with my sister for 5 years, and then I was born. She stayed home with me for 5 years, so she'd been out of school for 10 years, and she decided to go back. And so I was in kindergarten, and I was learning how to read and write, and she was getting her degree. And then she didn't stop there. She went on and got a master's. She started working toward a doctorate. So my whole childhood growing up, my mother was either a student or a teacher, because eventually she started to teach as well. And so I came up in this house of really strong women, and with the understanding that to be educated and to know things was truly valuable.
Mm.
And was powerful. And that was a part of her feminism as well, which was really inspirational to me. So one of the things that I'm excited about with this whole journey that I'm on is being able to have my own daughter see that. You know, she's only two, but I'm so proud of the fact that she will be able to look back and know that her mother did these things while being a mom and valued these things, and that's really special to me.
So teaching is one of those professions which, of course, very often can be incredibly rewarding for all the reasons why you were stating, but it's also really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you tell me about some of the challenges that you faced, or maybe times where it got tough for you?
Yeah, it's incredibly hard, you know, because you get into this work because you want to do right by kids, and you believe that all kids can learn, and with the right supports, all kids can be successful. And it often feels like there are just not enough hours in the day to help every single kid in the way that you need to or you want to. And that is an incredibly difficult feeling. So I often will talk to new teachers about the feeling of, you know, you're trying to juggle all of these different responsibilities and all of these different goals that you have, and you're constantly dropping one ball or another and constantly scrambling to pick it up and then dropping another. And I think a lot of teachers struggle with this sense of never being good enough at what we're doing and never doing enough to help the kids. And I think it's something that as teachers we really have to fight against, because there's a really, really healthy drive in teachers to constantly improve ourselves and to constantly learn more and to collaborate with one another to do better. But it can cross a line into a place where we're not taking the time to care for ourselves and acknowledge the good and the power in what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it can be really challenging to come up against.
I mean, has that happened to you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I joke with my principal all the time that I'm 10 years in and I still feel like I'm in my first year sometimes. I still feel like I have no idea what I'm doing. And I think that is in some ways really common for teachers. Teachers always want to get better. I mean, one of the reasons that we teach is because we love to learn, and we believe that we can always be learning. We're lifelong learners. And so, yeah, I've had so many times over the years where I've just felt like, oh, there's so much more I want to do, and how will I ever find the time to do all of this work?
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, it's a good challenge to have, but it can be hard.
So I'm wondering, now that you've been doing this for 10 years, what do you think are some of the lessons you've learned as an educator about things that work for students, or sort of broader things that we could sort of maybe ideally put into place, you know, in schools across the state?
Absolutely. So one thing I'm really invested in is just relationship building and thinking about how do teachers build relationships with students that enable us to do really hard work together. So the work that we're asking students to do is hard. And by building strong relationships with them and by building trust with students, we can really get them to do really hard work. We can get them to take risks. And ultimately, by taking risks, they're going to learn and grow so much more. So I'm really interested right now in the social and emotional learning work that's happening. And the state of Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, they are also putting resources into social and emotional learning, SEL, right now. So they've come out with revised frameworks that include references to SEL and are sort of getting feedback right now from educators across the state on that. So I'm really excited about that work. I think that anytime we can put time and thought and resources into thinking about our students' overall well-being, their social and emotional learning, as well as their academic learning and how those two things intertwine, we're going to be doing better by kids.
I feel like that's one of the things that we should like constantly be doing and learning no matter what age we are, right?
Absolutely.
Well, Sydney Chafee teaches ninth grade English and social studies at Codman Academy Charter Public School in Dorchester, and she is a finalist for National Teacher of the Year. The winner is going to be announced in the spring. She's also been named Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. So, Sydney Chafee, congratulations. We're all pulling for you in the spring. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The biggest barrier to getting most of our electricity from solar and wind power is no longer the cost of production, but the fact that we need power even when there is no sun or wind. In other words, we need better batteries. The state recently announced that electric companies in Massachusetts will soon have to install battery systems that can store and release huge amounts of energy on demand. Scientists at Harvard University say they're getting closer to being able to do that quickly, cheaply, and safely after having tested tens of thousands of compounds for building new batteries. And as WBUR's Bruce Gellerman reports, one potential battery ingredient is most at home in a pie.
Harvard grad student Andrew Wong lifts up the plastic laboratory safety hood and adjusts beakers filled with yellow and red liquids. Then he turns on a pump to power his experiment.
The second I start running this, you can actually see color changes. You'll see it turn really dark, and that's because of some of the properties of the organic molecules.
This small experimental energy storage system looks and works nothing like your typical household battery. Here, the electrochemical ingredients are dissolved in water and stored in beakers. When those electrolytic solutions flow near each other, they create an electric charge.
And then one of the questions is, how do you take these novel chemistries and then maximize their performance?
Flow batteries have been around for 40 years. They use metals that react to generate electricity. But Harvard professors Roy Gordon and Michael Aziz teamed up to produce power from organic molecules. They started using a class of compounds known as quinones. The name sounds exotic, but finding them is as easy as pie. Rhubarb pie.
The function of these molecules in rhubarb is to store and transfer energy.
The press picked up on that and called it a rhubarb battery. We prefer to call it an organic megaflow battery.
The idea of using organic molecules like those in rhubarb is new. But chemist Roy Gordon says it's based on a very old technology.
Biology suggests that that's where we ended up after a billion years of evolution, using these organic molecules to store the energy in our bodies.
Rhubarb, like all living things, even us, contains carbon. In plants, those carbon-containing quinone molecules are found in chlorophyll. It's chlorophyll that drives photosynthesis by picking up and giving off electrons over and over again. And Professor Aziz says they do it without any signs of wearing out.
That's exactly the functionality you want in a battery. So we found ways to make them soluble in water and to change the energies at which they pick up and give off electrons, put it in a battery, and it worked. And we've been developing that idea ever since.
The Harvard professor's rhubarb days were a few years ago. Since then, they evaluated hundreds of thousands of organic compounds to see which ones could store and discharge energy.
90% of the compounds that we've made and tested are unsuitable for one reason or another, so we try to weed them out quickly.
The researchers used mathematical models of chemical structures to determine which were promising. They tried aloe vera and vitamin K. Then the quest for quinones expanded to other kinds of organic molecules, including compounds containing nitrogen, like vitamin B2. Tweak it a bit, and it makes a pretty decent battery. Roy Gordon says it turns out there may be plenty of cheap and easily found organic chemical feedstocks. The basic starting point for making these carbon-based materials is coal and oil. Though not your typical clean energy fuels, when used in an organic megaflow storage system, They become renewable resources.
But it's not like burning it. It gets recycled in the batteries and keeps that carbon out of the atmosphere.
And the beauty of organic Megaflow batteries, says Professor Aziz, is that to increase the energy output, all you have to do is fill big dump tanks with cheap chemicals.
We know enough now to be optimistic that the costs, when they're mass-produced, of at least a couple of our favorite chemicals can be very, very low.
The question is, how big an organic Megaflow battery storage system would you need? Say, to store the electricity generated by the nation's first offshore wind farm, Block Island Wind.
Okay. So 30 megawatts of power. Suppose you want to store it for 10 hours. So that's 300 megawatt hours.
Aziz makes a back-of-the-envelope calculation.
300 million divided by actually 25 watt-hours per liter is more.
That's enough electric storage capacity to supply 17,000 homes.
It's 12,000 cubic meters.
That's big.
Yeah, it is. We're talking about very large storage tanks.
Actually, it's about twice the volume as the Goodyear blimp. But right now, the lab's storage cells are the size of postage stamps, and the electrolyte solutions fit into small beakers. The best experimental battery isn't very powerful.
Typically about 1 watt comes out of these batteries, all right? And if you want to back up a wind turbine, then you're at 1 million watts. And if you want to back up a power plant, you're at 1 billion watts.
Professors Aziz and Gordon are now working on a new chemistry. They can't disclose the details just yet, but they're testing it in their lab.
You can see the pump pulsing with our new top-secret chemical and pushing it out of this reservoir into the cell.
Aziz says the new class of organic molecules they're testing can pick up and give off electrons faster, better, cheaper.
This is the secret sauce. The black thing in the background is the secret sauce. If your eyes have spectrophotometers, you might be able to figure out, get a hint or two about what it is.
The Harvard scientists expect their research will be published soon. The challenge now is to scale up their work and create a cost-effective commercial battery. The U.S. Department of Energy has set the price and performance target to deliver the best bang for the buck in order to meet the renewable energy holy grail. Professor Michael Aziz believes he and his team are well on their way.
We have a fighting chance of being below $100 a kilowatt hour. And if we can do that, it will change the electricity system in this country and a lot of the world.
That report from WBUR's Bruce Gellerman, and I'm hoping those better batteries can make it into our phones as well. Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Being in a violent country, you cannot act as though violence is not happening.
This is renowned artist Doris Salcedo. She lives and works in Colombia.
That's why I think art has to somehow create a balance. Then you can create art that might create some meaning. And that meaning might help us ask difficult questions. Art does not give answers, only poses questions.
And those questions, who perpetrates violence? Who are their victims? How does it happen? Why? Those questions powerfully envelop visitors to the Materiality of Mourning, an exhibition of Salcedo's work currently on display at the Harvard Art Museums. We recently took a tour with curator Mary Schneider Enriquez.
She talks with the victims and the survivors of whatever the political violence was, and through that long series of discussions, learns, you know, the sorrow they've suffered, the extreme violence that occurred, and also begins to formulate in her mind what she wants to do to create as a kind of response and addressing that kind of mourning that they are in now.
Walking into the exhibit, you immediately feel its central tension. This is an experience of mostly empty space, yet heavily freighted. Just four rooms, all white walls, dimmed light. And there, in one corner, a large fabric, seemingly strewn onto the floor, the rusty color of coagulated blood.
We're looking right now at a fleur de piel, which is a piece created out of thousands of rose petals, a tapestry of roses, but it's really a shroud of roses that are suspended between life and death. And so it looks quite literally almost like dried blood.
It's Salcedo's version of a burial shroud. The artist had heard the story of a Colombian nurse who'd been kidnapped and tortured to death after giving medical aid to both sides of the Colombian Civil War. The nurse's body was never found, and Enriquez says Salcedo was so moved by the story, she decided to make a flower offering for the nurse, similar to what the woman would have received at a proper burial.
And that flower offering, she wanted to be something that was so difficult to make and so vivid and expressive of the kind of pain and really reverence that she felt for this victim. So over 4 years, she and her assistants worked on a means by which trying to find a way to preserve these rose petals in a state in which, as you'll see them now, they remain somewhat alive in the sense that they're still this lovely soft petal. But they were coated in chemicals that allowed them to exist beyond that. So it's a whole series of steps in terms of engineering and science that was a key part of creating this so that you have this lasting tapestry or shroud to this woman who died.
Right.
Everything about her work is meant for slow and careful and close looking. It's not you walk through the gallery quickly and you can get it all. No, you really need to take the time with it. Which is, in fact, one of the reasons this exhibition is called The Materiality of Mourning, because each of her pieces, from the beginning up to the present, is about creating this space in which to address the fact that people have lost someone to war and to political violence, very particularly.
Right. So can you tell me more about that? Because there's something very powerful about taking what is such a profoundly dark and intimate emotion such as mourning and loss and trying to, you know, make it manifest in a physical object of art. Mm-hmm. Has this been something that's driven Salcedo for her entire career?
Yes. Yeah. It is the primary theme in her work. It's about taking things we're familiar with and making them strange and odd and haunting and unsettling as a means of forcing the viewer to enter a space and respond to the work in such a way that you are off-put, you are unsettled, and that sense of the strangeness and that sadness is to stop you and make you think, see, and feel.
You see the delicate yet bloody browns of Salcedo's rose petal burial shroud. You think about the blood-stained sheet that probably wraps the body of the tortured nurse. You feel her family's and her nation's loss. Salcedo's work is probably most powerful when she confronts Colombia's national mourning, a nation that's been devastated by decades of civil war.
In 1985, November 6th and 7th, in the center of Bogota, the Supreme Court building, which is called the Palace of Justice, leftist guerrilla group took over the building while the Supreme Court was in session. And the government sent in the military after them to remove them. A fire began, and basically the entire building was torched, killing everyone except one of the Supreme Court justices. Obviously, this was a huge national tragedy, and one that was something that people still live and are aware of and are, and deeply feel a sadness about. So Doris felt that there needed to be some kind of response to this, and she wanted to create something. So she asked to see if there were any remnants from the fire, from the building, that she could use to create a sculpture. And she was told no, so she had to come up with her own response.
And Salcedo's response is on display at the Harvard exhibit. Curator Mary Schneider Enriquez takes us to the room. It's filled with chairs.
These chairs, with raw material, she created them. And what they are is a basic wooden chair that she has actually rather than having the wooden chair and the remnant from that building, she has taken the model of that chair, the idea of it, and she created in her studio in wax this whole basic chair, then sent it to a foundry in New York State where they cast it in stainless steel, sent all of the pieces of chairs back to Bogota, and Doris and her assistants hand-carved in the surface of each of these chairs the grain of wood, the nail hole, the chip, any gouge, so that it looks, when you come into the room and see these works, as if you are seeing an actual kind of worn chair.
At first glance, they look like normal gray chairs, but there's something not quite right. Some are askew or crushed. Some are smashed together. They're scattered around the room. There's damage and discord.
Each of these chairs has actually been fused together in a very forceful, obviously deliberate way, as if violence has occurred. So it's no longer a single chair. It's groups of chairs that are contorted and strange. The legs are bent. The seats are crumpled. But they are the chairs of each of those individuals who actually were killed. And she says, when violence has occurred to you in the, you know, the confines of your home or on your, you know, your neighborhood street or in the market where you buy your fruit, you can never go back and be in those spaces and not live and remember and be haunted by what occurred.
So Colombia's civil war is more than half a century long, thousands and thousands and thousands of people killed over that time. How do Colombians themselves react to the works?
As part of her commemoration of this exact event, and this will give you an answer to your question exactly, the response. So in 2002, which is when she created these stainless steel chairs, she did a performance piece, so to speak, which was with no public announcement whatsoever on the top of that Supreme Court building, the new one that's there now, at precisely the moment in the morning on November 6th in which the siege began in the old Supreme Court building. A single chair, like the simple chair, was suspended and began to go down the side of the building, and then another one and another one. Over the course of the exact time frame of the siege, more and more chairs slowly came down the side of the building. And as I said, there had been no announcement of this, so it's been filmed and there are photographs. You would watch passersby, you know, doing their daily work on November 6th in 2002, and they walk by this building, and then they see this chair coming over the side, and it's just a basic chair, and then another one, and very, very slowly, as I said, until the wall was filled, I mean, day and night this happened, until the wall was filled by the next day with all these chairs cockeyed together, clustered, I mean, very oddly hanging, the point being, obviously, each chair held the trace of a body that no longer exists. And so the potency of this statement, without huge declarations and lots of announcements, but it was inserted into people's daily lives, became this extremely powerful symbolism of the tragedy.
I mean, because her work sort of forces us to confront the reality of why we're mourning, right? And the effect that that has. You know, you were saying earlier that you've seen people respond very powerfully to individual pieces. Mm-hmm. What is the work here that you most powerfully respond to?
Actually, this room.
This room.
And when I began this job, the first piece I acquired as the curator of modern contemporary art was one of these stainless steel chairs that you see in this room. And to be very frank with you, which probably shouldn't be on the radio, but when we'd finished the installation and Doris and her team, her studio assistants, had left for the day, and I snuck one of my fellow curators in and said, look, no one had seen it, seen the exhibition. And I brought her in, and she knew very well how deeply I care about this work. And we walked into the first room, we walked into the second room, and involuntarily tears came down my cheeks. And she just looked at me and hugged me because she knew how much it mattered. So I get emotional now, too. Anyway, clearly I love this work.
Tell me more. Why do you think it's important for people to see it now?
Oh, gosh. You know, 5 years ago I began working on this, and I knew it was important because I'd lived in Latin America. I knew how her work was dealing with issues that were everywhere, whether it was happening in Yemen, it was happening in Bosnia. I mean, all the political violence in the world how do we respond with art to that? Because art can give you a way into thinking and feeling and hopefully bring us to a new place where we don't do these things again and again. So 5 years ago, I was thinking about this. And then we have our election. And, you know, as we worry about the uncertainties in the world, we're, many of us are even more worried about those uncertainties in our own country and how we as a nation will respond within ourselves as well as to the rest of the world. And our new presidential situation makes me more fearful, but at the same time, this work reminds us that there is a human spirit, we can get through it. I see this as really important right now because I want it to give us hope that we can go forward.
Well, thank you so much for bringing Salcedo's work here to the Harvard Art Museums for all of us to witness and experience. And thank you for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Mary Schneider Enriquez is the Houghton Associate Curator of Modern Art at the Harvard Art Museums. She guided us through the exhibition Doris Salcedo, The Materiality of Mourning. It's on display through early April. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.